You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
I'm Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon. And you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. This is The Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
On this evening's The Space Show, we have the fill-in administrator for NASA with a few comments about the NASA budget. And we have the astronauts of the first lunar orbiting mission. Do you know what that was? When it was? Well, we'll tell you. And the former Apollo Mission Control Flight Director, Jerry Griffin, will remember his experiences. And excitement, excitement, applause, applause. The draw for the names of the Space Association members who will be going to see the movie Mission Control, the unsung heroes of Apollo. And they'll also get to have a chance to ask questions with Apollo 16 moonwalker Charlie Duke and flight director Jerry Griffin live at the Astor Cinema in St Kilda or at other venues around Australia. And some lucky members of the Space Association of Australia, which presents this program, are going to be going to those lectures gratis. Yes, for free, if you are a member. And if you are the lucky person who gets your name drawn out from the hat, which we're going to do live to air right here on The Space Show on 88.3 Southern FM later this in the show, you know, coming up towards maybe 10 to 8 or something like that. Now, Robert Lightfoot is the acting administrator at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C., and recently he spoke at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, to announce NASA's budget request. Now, this is what is requested, not what will actually happen, possibly. Anyway, he set out the goals of NASA in low Earth orbit.
We need to be able to look back into low Earth orbit and see a vibrant economy, an economy that we've created and we've spurred with things like the International Space Station and how we've used the International Space Station to do that. As such, this budget proposes to stimulate commercial industry opportunities in low Earth orbit, providing an off-ramp for government-led operations at the International Space Station. So what we'll do is we'll ramp up efforts to transition low Earth orbit activities to the commercial sector and to indirect federal government support of the ISS in 2025. Hopefully to begin relying on commercial partners for our low Earth orbit research and technology and demonstration requirements. To that end, this budget proposes $150 million in 2019 to encourage the U.S. space industry to develop the capabilities and bring all those capabilities to bear in low Earth orbit, either at the ISS or on standalone platforms that both private sector and NASA can use. This budget also continues to support for the commercial crew and cargo programs, with both providers and crew providing continue to make great progress toward launching astronauts from the U.S. This is a critical part of our low Earth orbit strategy and something we've been wanting to have occur for a long time. On the cargo side, we've just awarded Sierra Nevada their first cargo mission, so we continue to engage other commercial folks as well in this process. So that's in this budget. And finally, in the budget for the low Earth orbit and kind of the support to commercialization, we have the budget supports space communications, propulsion test, and launch services. These are all critical part of kind of our, what I call our infrastructure, and the things that are necessary to do any kind of work in space these days.
In speaking at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, Robert Lightfoot, the acting administrator of NASA headquarters, had this to say about NASA's goals in going deeper into space towards the moon and perhaps even beyond.
So I'm going to start with the lunar part and share with you what's going on there. So first of all, the Space Launch System and Orion spacecraft are critical backbone elements of that future in deep space, whether it's lunar and beyond. Their momentum continues this year as the budget supports the current planning for the uncrewed and the crewed missions that we need to get crewed around the moon. SLS core stage hardware, as Todd mentioned, is completing manufacturing and preparing to be structurally tested here at Marshall. We've already started some of that structural testing with the engine section already here, and the tests are going well. Orion, led by the team at Johnson Space Center, continues its great progress across the country. The main capsule at Kennedy Space Center is really just hitting their stride with the amount of testing they're doing as well, getting the systems ready all over this great nation. The team at Stennis is preparing for the integrated test of the SLS with the RS-25s. That's going to be quite a test that we get to see here soon. And then the ground systems team at Kennedy is preparing to receive all this hardware while preparing the mobile launcher, the VAB, and the software we need to launch this vehicle as we go forward. So it's a pretty exciting time. You just have to go to any of the centers, and as Todd says, people are pretty jazzed up about what they're doing and getting to do to get us ready to go fly this. And this upcoming year is going to be all about testing for that, and the 19 budget supports all that.
Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
I'm Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon, and you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. This is the Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
Well, we are about to turn blue because, yes, Charlie Duke, his in person, is coming to our broadcast area, to the Astor Cinema, and we have details about that coming up later. Now, I asked you at the beginning of the show, do you remember the first human flight to the moon? Not to land on the moon, but to the moon. And that was, yes, did you get it? Apollo 8. And do you know when it was? Well, it was in 1968, December. And do you know who the crew were? Okay. Well, we'll find out as we go on. Now, speaking at the Lyndon Baines Johnson Presidential Library in 2009, April the 23rd, were the three crew members of the Apollo 8 flight. And those crew members were in discussion with a journalist. And here's something that Borman said about the people who supported the Apollo program.
I'd like to begin to let you hear the true story from the three folks who are here this evening. Frank, you told me earlier that you'd like to elaborate on what I was saying about these people who are here tonight.
Yeah, you know, it's very dangerous. One of the ways you could really get in trouble in the astronaut program was to say, well, the astronauts think this or the astronauts think that. John Glenn used to really irritate me when he was running for office because I didn't think like John Glenn at all, but nevertheless, I was accused of thinking like John Glenn. But I have checked with my two wonderful companions, and they agree with me that we really owe a debt of gratitude to the Apollo alumni here. You have not received near the credit you deserve. We wouldn't be here today without you, and it chokes me up just thinking of the trust that we had in you. And one guy really personifies it. Of all the people that made NASA work, the real giants in NASA, there's really only one left, and that's Chris Kraft. And Chris, I just want to thank you. And when, you know, when I hear today, and I'll shut up, but when I hear today about how these young people are so wonderful, that's nonsense. They weren't any better than you guys. The average age of the people that programmed our trajectory was 24 years. You guys were the best, and you could do a hell of a lot better job than anybody's doing today, and we appreciate you. Okay, I'll shut up.
At another function, some of the flight controllers were paid tribute to, and Joe Allen, a former astronaut, gave a biographical introduction of Gerald Griffin, or Jerry Griffin, as he's more commonly known. He was a flight director during the Apollo Mission Control, and he is going to be here at the Astor Cinema in early May. Again, later in the show, we're giving the tickets to some people who are going to be going to that show. Anyway, here's Joe Allen.
From Athens, Texas. Jerry went from Athens and spent an enormous amount of time at Texas A&M. I think he's still receiving remedial instruction from there. Was a flight director beginning with Gemini 11, having come to JSC in 64, and then worked most of the Apollo missions, if not well, I think probably all. He was the lead flight director on 12, 15, and 17. He went on to many other assignments since that time, including the director of the Johnson Space Center, and he's currently with a headhunting firm here in Houston, Texas. Not yet successful. He's not found gainful employment for me as yet.
Now, back to Frank Borman, Bill Anders, and Jim Lovell, the Apollo 8 astronauts, speaking at the Lyndon Baines Johnson Presidential Library in 2009.
Now comes a period of quietude. You've got, what, 2 days with not much to do?
We might as well get it out right now. I got motion sick and puked.
I was not going to...
Frank, we weren't going to say anything.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I read now, I say, oh, they were thinking, like NASA was thinking about canceling the mission and all that. I want to tell you something. We would have had radio failure. If you ever sent that up, Chris, no way. But I got over in a hurry, and I think that it was clearly, although I didn't think so at the time, because I'd flown two weeks in Gemini without getting sick. And I'd never been sick in an airplane except when I was hungover.
It's
so,
a...
So I don't really believe, I think it was a motion sickness.
Well, I convinced Frank that we ought to give the ground some
kind... Yeah, it was your fault.
Some kind of signal. Well, after I had to bat all that stuff away, I mean... But we had a tape recorder that the ground could command on a private channel, because everything we said, you know, went out to the world. So, Frank, I got him on the tape recorder, and I figured, and I made some comment about, well, you know, you guys, maybe you'll check the tape sometime. And I don't know where Chuck Berry was. Maybe he was sound asleep. But about 8 hours later, all hell broke loose. They finally listened to the tape recorder. By this time, Frank had recovered, so... Thank God they didn't cancel the flight.
No, we weren't going to cancel. We would have shut down the radio. We would have kept you on because we knew what happened.
No comprendo.
This is another thing they never told us journalists. We never knew about this until many years later. I see you mentioned Dr. Berry. Dr. Chuck Berry was there, the astronaut physician for many, many years, who's here tonight. That motion sickness, it didn't only happen to you, it happened to some other people, and there was no predicting it, is my understanding. It was not like air sickness, was it?
I don't know anything about it. I mean, I just got nauseated, and I thought it was because I'd taken a Secinol, which was a sleeping. I never take pills, and I'd taken one, and I thought that's what done it, but I believe now I probably have motion sickness.
I think it's a common phenomenon. I think most of the astronauts, even today in the shuttle, for the first 6 hours, if you're not careful, if you start moving sideways and things like that, you can get nauseous. So it's a phenomenon.
Well, you and Bill both said you felt queasy.
Yeah, when I got out of the seat for the first time, my job was to collect the helmets, and I thought, well, I'll just do a little nip up, you know, and I did two of them and said, I'm laying down and I'm not going to move my head.
Yeah. Did you get sick on 13?
No, surprisingly, I did not. But on 8, when I first got out, because I had to do some work too, I felt a little nauseous. But I kept my head straight ahead.
That was CO2.
And that way, you grin and bear it. And after a while, your stomach gets used to it. In fact, most people, the stomach gets used to it.
And now back to the event in Houston, where Glenn Lunny and Gerald Griffin talked about a glitch with the Apollo 8 engine.
In retrospect, that was a major systems problem that had to be dealt with and was dealt with right. And the situation we were faced with was there was the possibility that after the first burn, we could have done another little one and then another little one later to take it out, but we had to do those fairly quickly. So there was an urgency to deciding whether we would try another test on the engine or not, and it fell to me on my shift to deal with that problem. Well, at the same time, and I don't even know if this is public knowledge, but at the same time, there was a report from the crew that one of the crew members was ill. So this seemed to attract all of the high management's brains. Everybody that I thought I could get some help from, they were all off working on the fact that this guy got sick, which I didn't really care about because it wasn't a bloody thing that we could do about it that I knew of. So just be sick and be quiet about it, for God's sake. So,
he didn't have it.
So anyway, while everybody else except the propulsion guys are over here worrying about this so-called sick astronaut, it fell to me to deal with this issue of, well, are we going to burn this thing another time and see if it works? And can we get it back and then do a burn after that to get us back on the trajectory we want? And we couldn't do too much because we were running out of fuel if we did too much of that fooling around. And if we're going to do anything, we had to do it in a big hurry. So after a whole bunch of deliberations with the people that Cliff talked about, I just took a deep breath, looked around one more time for the sick astronaut committee, and they were nowhere in sight, and said, well, you're right, it sounds all right to me, we're going to go ahead. And we didn't do any burns, and we set the track for the Apollo 8 mission, but boy, I sure felt like the Lone Ranger for quite a while there.
Well, can I add, I'll add something to that. It so happened that I was kind of riding shotgun on Apollo 8 and without a lot of detail to you, so I was put on that sick astronaut committee for you. But you got to, one thing to put in context here, we had never left the influence of Earth's gravity. And there was a worry amongst the sick astronaut committee that, my gosh, this means that there's something that we don't know about heading out of the Earth's influence, and it's caused this astronaut to get sick. Well, as most of you know, later on, we've had some of that almost on every flight. But it was a very serious concern, and here was Pearl Glenn wrestling with all the technical stuff. But we did get finally solved, and in fact, the astronaut did fine a little later, which is the typical pattern once you get into orbit. Go ahead.
There's the advantage of being the lead flight director. You see, you just delegate all those tough ones to these other guys.
In 2008, PBS television in America made a documentary on the Apollo 8 mission, and Glenn Lunny was a guest on that. And here is Glenn and the documentary narrator talking about that engine problem.
11 hours into the flight, with another 2.5 days to go before they reached the moon, Frank Borman was the first scheduled for sleep. But before he turned in, the crew had one crucial maneuver to perform, a short test of the only remaining engine, the Service Propulsion System, or SPS. At the moon, it would have to slow the command module enough to allow it to drop into lunar orbit. After orbiting the moon 10 times, the SPS would have to burn again to send the crew home.
2, 1, mark.
Houston, Apollo 8.
Go ahead.
Roger, the burn time was...
Initial readings showed that the SPS test looked good. For a couple of restless hours, Borman tossed and turned in a hammock below the seats, struggling with nausea. Then, after taking a sleeping pill, he became seriously ill with both vomiting and diarrhea. When doctors in Mission Control learned of Borman's condition, they immediately suspected a virus in the capsule. The doctors alerted the Apollo directors, and they slipped out of Mission Control for a private conference about whether to abort the mission. While they were absent, Mission Control was jolted by more bad news. Closer analysis of the SPS test showed a slight malfunction.
We fired this engine, which was a confidence burn. It was intended to give us confidence that this engine, which we were counting on at the moon, was going to be all right. Lo and behold, the engine didn't behave properly. So we were sitting here looking at that, stuck with, oh my God, is this engine not working right? Does this mean we cannot go all the way to the moon and put the vehicle in orbit? Do we have to turn around and come back?
After 10 minutes of anxious debate, NASA engineers reported that the malfunction was likely temporary, and they believed the engine would work properly when fired again to go into lunar orbit. Without enough fuel to test the engine again, 32-year-old flight director Glenn Lunny made the call to proceed on course. When Kraft and Lowe returned from their deliberations over Borman's illness, they accepted the decision on the SPS, having made a similar call about the crew's health. By now, the commander was feeling a little better, and the other astronauts were showing no signs of infection. Though off to a rocky start, the mission would continue as planned.
Okay, we're rolling around to a good view of the Earth.
Gerard Griffin, can now explain the daring yet step-by-step evolution of the Apollo missions towards Apollo 11.
Well, I'll kind of pick up where Cliff left there and step quickly and kind of bring maybe me and Steve up to the Apollo 11 time frame when we landed on the moon. Apollo 8 mission was kind of scary in a way, and the reason that it was kind of scary is that it, in the courage that he mentioned to take that step, is that everything we had done up to that point, with the possible exception of the EVA that we did in Gemini, we had built a very careful building block approach. Add one thing at a time and take the next step. And Apollo 8 kind of jumped out of that for a good reason. It pushed the system, I think, to go on faster and well within constraints of safety. But it showed an ability to take risk, and I think that's where when it's measured and when the gain is worth the risk. And I think that's where Cliff and I really agree that those kinds of things are getting harder and harder to do. But let me get to that building block approach. Glenn kind of brought you through what built up to get us to Apollo 7. And for the most part, Apollo itself had that same building block approach. After 8, the next thing we did was Apollo 9, which was a low Earth orbit, back in Earth orbit again, but we added additional step to it. We added the lunar module. And the lunar module and the command module docked together just like it would be at the moon or in Earth orbit, and we undocked them and separated them. It was the first time we'd ever done anything like that, and had two people in the LM, the lunar module, without a heat shield. It was the first time we'd ever had anybody in orbit that didn't have a protective heat shield to get down. And that was a significant step. But we also proved that we could rendezvous, redock, transfer the crew back in, discard the LM, and re-enter the command module. Now, that had to be done to return from the moon. So that was another step in the process. Apollo 10 came right after that. We had already been to the moon on Apollo 8 to go into orbit. Apollo 10 was another let's go into orbit around the moon, but it had the lunar module with it, which was another additional step. And we did the same thing in lunar orbit, that something like we had done in Earth orbit on Apollo 9. We separated. The crewmen, Tom Stafford and Gene Cernan, went down very low to the surface but didn't land. But they were close. In fact, some of you may remember Gene Cernan saying we're really down amongst them, and that was because he could see the mountains higher, or at least appearing to be higher, like most airplane pilots think they're higher than they are, and they probably weren't. But they really got down low, and then they didn't abort and came up just like they would have had to in the event of an emergency. But this one was planned. It wasn't planned to touch down. So here we built another block. They came back up, rendezvoused with the command module. Command module did its maneuver and brought them home. So you can see this step by step creeping up on the problem. And by the time we launched Apollo 11, the control team was ready. The launch people at CAPE had been through it several times. The astronauts, very well prepared. But there was a difference about 11. And I think some of us probably, they were involved in it day to day, and I'd like to get the reaction of these guys. I don't think we felt the importance of it then like we did in later years. This was... And I get back to that building block process. It was another step on a goal we had been pursuing for so long that many of us didn't think of it, I don't think, as being this profound step. We saw it as a great achievement that we wanted to make happen, but we didn't understand maybe what the rest of the world, how they felt about it. And we started, I can remember, and I've thought about this a lot in the last week or two because I've had people asked me about it and reporters wanting to know what it was like. I can remember, on Apollo 11, I did a translunar shift, a sleep shift virtually on the way out and one on the way back. because I was already assigned Apollo 12 as the lead flight director and was already starting to think about that flight. But I can remember being, although we were on a high step and ready to do it, just like we had on 10, I didn't feel a great difference in the start. I didn't have a different feeling than I had from 10. And I took it kind of as one step. We've done this. We've been here. We keep going. And I can remember very clearly where the difference came. Now, Steve, for him, he'll probably talk about some of the alarms that we got on Apollo. Probably started there for him. It didn't for me because I knew he had that under control and it was a piece of cake. But what I really remember is when Buzz said, "We're starting to pick up some dust." And I can remember to this day that I had the realization, he's talking about dust being blown off the moon by the descent engine. And that was a step we had not taken yet. And from there on, that flight had a great different feeling for me. And then, surprisingly, once we got off the moon and back up to the lunar orbit point, I felt, well, we've done this before, and it should be okay. But that interim period was that last step of that building block that we hadn't done yet, so it put that great difference to it. I think the mission control team's reaction to the landing is kind of understandable. While there was great euphoria, I think probably individually, there was no wild screaming or anything like that. In fact, Commandant Kranz was the flight director. And as those of you that know Gene Kranz, and those of you don't, I'll tell you a little bit about him. Probably one of the toughest disciplinarian kinds of guys in the world. Very, extremely thorough, right on top of the situation. Gene Kranz was and is a national asset, and he was just the right guy to be running the control center that day. He kept a calmness to it. We had some abort opportunities planned there early. I think we called them T1 and T2, and we didn't know if when the limb touched down, it might start to, one of the gears might start to sink, and we might have to punch off immediately. But we did also have some windows pointed out where we would do these systems checks quickly, and if there was an opportunity to abort, we had the command module in the right space for him to get back to it. So it was a very business-like atmosphere, kind of a calm sort of thing. On a personal note, as soon as we touched down and I realized we had done it, and it was all very exciting, I started thinking about Apollo 12, actually before they even had done their EVA, because we had already started talking about what we were going to try to do on Apollo 12, which was a pretty exacting test. And but that built on, and the control center throughout that entire period stay was a very subdued, professional kind of atmosphere. I can remember, and while I can't tell you exactly what it said, I can remember one humorous note that since I was kind of working the night shifts, I came in one night and one of our flight controllers had put up on one of the big screens about the size of this thing over here some comment not too kind about the Russians. And other than that, I didn't see any frivolity in the control center throughout that whole period. Great, great opportunity and a great day for the country to think about now 20 years later. One final thought, and we were talking about this as we were standing up here before this started today. One of the things that just amazes me about that whole period leading up to the lunar landing, and even now to some degree, was the youthfulness of that control team. If I'm not mistaken, I think at that point, the man to my left here was in his mid-30s, and he was the oldest flight director. I won't pin it down to you. I think he was the oldest flight director, even older than Kranz. But we were all a bunch of young people. Steve Bales in his 20s. When I think about marshaling that kind of energy and vigor and the interest that was shown, and we still see signs of that today, obviously. We did have a team of management on top of us, some of them older than that, that were very, very supportive and very visionary and very, very good. But I think back to the young people that made that happen and kind of marvel that it could have been done by people so young. We had, Glenn and I know have talked about this, we probably had more responsibility at about age 30 than most people will have in a lifetime. And we had that opportunity because NASA gave it to us.
Jared Griffin now describes his involvement in the Apollo 12 mission. He had one error in his memory recall. The Apollo 12 in 1969 November came 2 years after the unmanned Surveyor 3 landing, not 7 years as Jerry recalled. Jared Griffin, coming to Melbourne, the draw coming up in about 5 minutes' time.
What we did after 11, in a very summary way, can just say was nothing short of fantastic. We went back, one flight we aborted. And let me tell you about, in keeping with what Steve said about Gene Kranz, it was the mission that he was the lead on. It was always the toughest. The really tough mission was Apollo 12. that's because I was the lead flight director on Apollo 12. And it was an interesting flight. And it's a kind of an example of every one of these flights had every one of them we could sit and talk, particularly this crowd up here and some of you could talk about every one of these flights in great detail because they all had their own personality. Apollo 12 is one you may remember. We got hit by lightning about 50 seconds after launch.
With an Aggie flight director.
Yeah, Cliff says with an Aggie flight director. And we handled that. I thought we were going to have to abort. But thank God the Saturn V kept working and got us into Earth orbit. It was a very interesting mission in that we went and landed, did a pinpoint landing next to the Surveyor spacecraft, which had been sent up there unmanned 7 years earlier. And the crew of Conrad and Bean actually got out and got some pieces off of that spacecraft. And picking up on what Steve said, with our uncertainties about the moon's homogeneity, the idea that it's not a good sphere until you know all of where the mass cons are, and we weren't sure we could do it. Now, I was the lead flight director for that flight, and Cliff Charlesworth did the landing phase. And he's never forgiven me. We had a custom in those days when you were lead flight director the first time, you got the NASA Exceptional Service Medal. And I got my medal, and the salutation lauds me for performing the pinpoint landing that Clifford was the flight director for. And he's never forgiven me for it. One of these days, I'm going to give you that medal.
Good.
Just so you can have it. But anyhow, 13 turned out to be a real excitement because of the problem that we had with the oxygen tank blowing up. On the way to the moon, we had to abort. 14, 15, 16 all had their problems and their successes. And I think celebrating Apollo 11 like we are at this time is a great time to reflect on every one of those missions because it's the only time that we can talk about the whole program and kind of celebrate it together because we don't celebrate those other flights the way we did will this one. But I think I just wanted to get that plug in there for those other missions that came after.
And that was Gerald Griffin. Now, we're going to be giving some lucky people a chance to meet Gerald. But first, let's hear these station messages.
Why not visit 88.3 Southern FM's new look website? On there, you'll find full details of all your favorite programs and presenters, information about what's coming up on the station, and details of our sponsors. You can also drop us an email, leave your feedback, or stream Southern FM's broadcast live. And while you're there, click through to our Facebook page and become a fan of Southern FM. And you can also follow us on Twitter for all the latest updates. You'll find all that and much more at www.southernfm.com.au.
Hi, this is Mark Holden, and you're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
We have been promising here on the Space Show, which is presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Some members of the association are going to be going to hear Jerry Griffin and Charlie Duke. Now, let's hear that Charlie Duke promo again, please.
I'm Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon. The Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
What a ride. So, here we go. We've got in the studio with us two other members of the Space Association, the Heavenly Twins, the Gemini Twins, and that's Michael Abdillo and Angelo DiGrazio.
Thank you,
welcome
Andrew.
To the show.
thank you, Andrew. Nice introduction.
Yes.
And you're going to be, now, first of all, let's clarify the rules for this. First of all, am I eligible to win?
No, members of the committee of the Space Association of Australia are not eligible to win a free ticket, no.
Ah, so I should not have been on the committee.
That's correct. That's
okay, correct. Right. So just be clarifying that I'm not eligible. Michael, are you eligible?
No, I'm not. No.
And Angelo, are you eligible?
Yes, I am. Mm.
You are?
Yes, because I'm not part of the committee.
Because you're not part of the committee.
Maybe I should join the committee. It might be less work.
Okay. So one member of the association present is eligible, so he's not going to be doing the draw because his name could come out. Jay, are you eligible?
No, because I'm not technically a member of Space Association. I'm just helping Andrew out. So.
Right. So we'll get Jay to do the honours on doing the pulling out of the hat, as it were. Now, Michael, what's the first draw?
Okay, so we're going to run through the cities that the tour, Australian tour of Mission Control, the Unsung Heroes of Apollo, will be going to. So the first draw is for Melbourne. For the Melbourne event, and eligible members, financial members of the Space Association of Australia in Victoria. And because we have most of our members in this state, we have been lucky enough to have six free tickets to that. So we're going to draw out six tickets from that group, and we'll announce those live to air. So.
Right, Jay is reaching into the hat, and he's pulling out.
Where is the drum roll effect?
The first rabbit's coming out. The first rabbit is, and the winner is, Peter Dyson.
Peter Dyson,
yes.
Well done.
Well done, Peter.
And another one.
All right, another one.
Peter, a long-standing member of the association.
Okay.
Hi, Peter.
I like this one. Let's see what it is.
Number two rabbit. And the winner is Mark Hillier. Well done, Mark. Well won. Okay.
All right. And the other one is... I think this one will do.
And the third is David Green. Well done, David.
And
any more of those?
Yep.
Yes, I can confirm that Jay is not looking into the hat. He's just reaching over and picking it out of the hat, and they're all folded over so he can't read the names anyway.
I mean, that's technically a bucket.
That's right.
Okay, and the fourth ticket goes to Lynn O'Halloran. Well done, Lynn.
Good on you, Lynn.
Congratulations.
Two more to go for the Melbourne event.
Tension now, tension's rising. Are the remaining Melbourne members, who is going to be going to this event?
Okay, the fifth ticket goes to Jeff Lead.
Good on you, Jeff.
Alrighty then.
And the last ticket?
The final ticket. Let's see.
Yes, drum roll.
There should be a drum roll here somewhere. Come on.
A bunch of guys about to turn blue.
Yeah.
Michael, come on, let's have it.
Oh, he's got it. He's got it. And the winner is Charlie Zerny. Well done.
Good on you, Charlie.
Well done, Charlie.
Yes.
Okay. So what we'll do now is continue around the country, and the next event will be held in Canberra. And now the situation in Canberra is that through circumstances which I won't go into, but we were offered some other tickets. So for Canberra, we actually have 5 tickets, and unfortunately, we only have 4 of our members from the ACT who were able to attend or to take up that offer. So we're going to announce those names now of the 4 people who are both eligible but also nominated for that draw.
Okay, and the first winner is Nathan Simmons.
Good on you, Nathan.
Congratulations, Nathan. And the next...
I finally found out I'm going to be using it all the time.
That's right.
The next is Beck Big Wither. Beck Big Wither. Congratulations, Beck.
Beck, okay.
Another one.
We have 2 more.
2 more.
Okay. Yep,
quick.
Oh, here it is. Yep. All right.
Yep.
And the winner is Adina Silverstein. Well done.
Great.
Silverstein.
Okay. So yes, they're the 4 winners for the...
One more.
Oh.
Sorry.
Is there one more? I'm sorry.
Yes, Adina was on the space show some weeks ago.
That's correct.
And the last person is Ruben Paramat Iswara.
Beautiful.
Well,
okay. Okay, so we have another ticket for the Canberra event, and what we're going to say is that if anyone would like to become a member of the Space Association of Australia, then you'll be eligible to take the 5th ticket for the Canberra event. So I'll just leave that out there, and hopefully someone will come back to us and join up to the association. We'll move on quickly to Sydney. We're running out of time here very quickly. So we have 2 tickets for Sydney, and so we need to pick 2 tickets.
So Jay's reaching in, and drum roll, here it is.
And the first ticket goes to Robert Carpenter.
Good on you, Robert. Well done.
The second winner is Tony Law.
Good on you, Tony. Well done.
Well done, Tony.
Okay, quickly moving on to Brisbane. Now, Brisbane, we have also 2 tickets available. However, our members in Queensland, only one of our members was able to take up the offer. So that person will get the ticket, and that person is...
James O'Connor.
Good on you, James. Well done. And again, the same as for Canberra, if there's anyone in Queensland who would like to join the Space Association of Australia, then you will also be eligible to take that second ticket in for the Brisbane event. And now, quickly, the final event is Perth, and we have 2 tickets for the Perth event.
The first Perth winner is Judith Rook.
Good on you, Judith. Well done.
And the second winner is Matteo Vinci.
Fantastic.
Well done.
Okay, and that's it, everybody. So people in Queensland and Canberra, if you'd like to join the association, you can have a ticket.
Right. Well, that's it, I think, for our space show. Coming up soon is Nick Black. But just very quickly, when is this event at the Astor Cinema?
At the Astor Theatre, it's on Wednesday, the 2nd of May.
Right, thank you.